My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. This is Jeff Lerner, your host. So excited to be back with you yet again, getting to have amazing conversations with amazing human beings. I am today joined by AJ Jacobs. He is a, I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but four times New York Times bestseller, a bestselling author of, honestly, some of the most interesting like concept books I've heard of. And I'm so excited to dig into detail. Honestly, I can't decide which one is most interesting to me. Hopefully we'll have time to talk about all of them. But he's the author of The Know-It-All, One Man's Humble Quest to Become the Smartest Person in the World. And basically, he read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. He's the author of The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. He has another book along the same lines, Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. We know three things about him. There's only one of them. He's a man and he's humble. Well, and four, and he goes on quests. All his books tell us as much. And then he had My Life as an Experiment, which almost seems like a meta book about his life because all his books are, he's like an experiment in making experiments. And that is One Man's Humble Quest to Improve Himself. AJ, Dos Equis guy got nothing on you, man. Most interesting man I've talked to. Actually, I've talked to some really interesting people today. I feel like that would be like diminishing to be like, you're the most interesting man I've talked to today. Cause I launched a book today and I've been doing like media all day. So I've talked to a variety of interesting people today, but you are certainly foremost among them. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be in the circle. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you're here. And I'm going to tell you right out of the gate. I love it. I have not read all your books. Is The Puzzler, is that your newest book?
That's right. Oh, that one just came out like a month ago.
And is that One Man's Humble Quest to Something Something?
You know, I took out the humble. I'm no longer humble. I'm totally.
After four New York Times bestsellers, he doesn't have to humbleize his quest
That's
anymore.
That's right. No more.
It's just one. Okay, I've got it right here. One Man's Quest to Solve the Most Baffling Puzzles Ever, from crosswords to jigsaws. I love this. To the Meaning of Life.
There it is.
And I actually have a copy of The Puzzler that was sent to me by my team not long enough ago that I've read it, but long enough ago that I've skimmed it, and I'm really excited to read it. Actually, it looks really cool.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, what I was saying was contextually, I love it. I love people. I find a kinship with people that are willing to kind of go to these extremes around things that they decide matter, whether or not anybody else in the world thinks they matter. You decide a thing matters and you'll go deep on it. I really, really respect that. Back me up though. How did you decide to become a person that goes on humble or not as humble quests and write about it?
Yeah. Well, I definitely, from listening to your podcast, I got the sense that you are a kindred spirit. I do these books because first I love them. I love to do them. You know, they can be incredibly painful and unpleasant while they're going on, but the takeaways are hopefully making my life better. I guess one of the reasons I do them is because people say, "Oh, write what you know and write about your life." And my life, I got to say, my childhood, not that interesting. You know, I grew up, I had relatively nice parents and, you know, they didn't, no one was a spy or.
They didn't traumatize you enough to make you into a tortured artist.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was a real disadvantage. But I am a huge work in progress. There are so many areas in my life that I needed to improve. So I thought, why don't I try to put myself in these really interesting positions and push it to the limit and see what works and what doesn't, and then report back so that the reader doesn't have to spend 2 years trying to be the healthiest person alive, or they don't have to spend a year following all the rules of the Bible. I'm going to do it for them and then report back what works and what doesn't.
And so when did this become a thing you were going to pursue? What age roughly?
Well, my first book was probably when I was 30, and it was I was inspired by my dad because he loved to read and he loved knowledge. And when I was a kid, he started to read the encyclopedia, but he didn't finish. He made it up to the letter B, like around Bolivia. And I thought, well, maybe I should try to finish what he started and restore honor to our family name. And so that
it was that or like Hari Kari, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. It was such a blemish. but that was the start of it. And that was, you know, trying to improve my mind, but then I tried to improve my body. I tried to improve my spirit. I keep going because sorry about that. I should have improved myself and not had the ringer on. See, always room for improvement.
Oh yeah. Work in progress.
That's right. I feel, there's always, experiments to be done. And you've talked about this on your podcast, the importance of having an experimental point of view on life and not doing the same thing all the time. I was listening to you talk about teenagers, and I do feel that is one of the advantages of youth, is that they are more open to trying new things. And so I try to keep that mindset myself and not get locked in, because our brains can be like, ski mountain, and the skis can make these ruts and you're stuck in those ruts. So I try to cope my mind mountain, to use a metaphor, with new snow all the time so that it doesn't get stuck in these ruts. And I think it makes me happier. I think it makes me more creative. As I still say, I'm still a work in progress. So it's always a discipline. It's a process. It's not like I'm done with self-improvement. It is always going on.
So let me ask you a question. So you'll take these things to, the way you described it was sort of an extreme or almost a dogmatic approach, right? Like zero tolerance for exceptions. And you say, I'll do that to some degree so that people can extract the wisdom from having done so, basically without having to do so themselves, right? I'll be extreme and bring back the insight so that they don't have to be extreme to go get the insight. So I'm curious how much you think the insight is transferable, or if the insight is, you know, call it like, physiological or even neurological learning that comes from the experience of having gone to that place, not so much like some cognitive, you know, observation that you can bring back and transfer like a piece of data.
Well, I would say there's both. First of all, there's just wisdom that I try to bring back that hopefully will encourage people to do their own experimenting. And they don't have to go to the extreme. That's the point, is that they can incorporate it in. So I'll give you an example. My book before The Puzzler was called Thanks a Thousand. And I went around the world and I tried to thank 1,000 people who had anything to do with my morning cup of coffee. So I thanked the barista, and I went to South America and I thanked the coffee farmer. But I thanked the logo designer. I thanked the guy who drove the truck with the coffee beans. I thanked the people who paved the road because he couldn't drive his truck without the pay. So I just took it. I realized there are hundreds, thousands of people who we totally take for granted, who make our lives possible. And it didn't have to be coffee. It could be a sock. It could be toothpaste, pen. Yeah. It doesn't matter. The thing is, it's a network. It is a huge 6 degrees of gratitude is what I called it. So, and that changed my life for the better, just going out there and realizing and thanking people. But you don't have to do that. I mean, I've gotten so many emails and schools actually that contact me and say, you know, we're doing our own version of it. It's not 1,000 people, it's 10 people. Or it's just, you know, every day deciding to send a note to a logo design. You know, you see a logo you love. The logo people, they don't get the feedback. You know, they're not on the front lines. So it makes their day. to get just a little note. So that would be my answer. It definitely does transfer.
So there's a certain amount of what you would call like timeless wisdom that is transferable from the standpoint of, like, even if they didn't share the experience, they can share the perspective that you, right, that you gained from the experience. And then talk to me about some of the lessons that maybe aren't transferable. I suspect you get invited onto shows to talk a lot about what you learned and what you can share. I'm going to maybe take a different approach. What is it that you learned doing these things that you actually don't think you could ever really transfer to someone?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess, this meta lesson is transferable, but then I'll show you the actual experience was not transferable. I tried to describe it, but right, I could. But the meta lesson was how much your behavior affects your thoughts and feelings, how much the outer affects the inner. And that's been a theme throughout my books. So with the thank you book, for instance, I'd wake up, I feel that I was born more Larry David than Mr. Rogers, like if you had to split it up. So I would wake up.
I would rather hang out with you then. I mean, I think Mr. Rogers is cool, but I'd love to hang out with Larry David.
Well, I'll tell you, I would, would I rather watch Curb Your Enthusiasm than Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Yes, it's hilarious. It's much better. But you don't want to be in that mindset. You want to hang out with them. But
right,
being the Larry David mindset and noticing everything that's negative is not a fun way to live. I can tell you because I've lived that way and I still struggle with it. So I might wake up in a more Larry David mood, but I would force myself to act as if I were grateful, and I would write thank you notes, go to people, call people. Mm. And after a couple of hours, your mind catches up with your actions, and the sort of fake it till you feel it theory. Cognitive behavioral therapy talks about this a lot.
Yeah.
And it's ancient wisdom too.
I'm a 10-year CBT junkie. So
I am too. I've been doing it a long time. I'm a huge fan. So anyway, that the meta lesson is transferable, that acting, you can act your way into a new way. There's a great quote. I didn't come up with myself. I wish I did. It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. So that's the meta lesson. Like, if you want to be optimistic, act as if you're optimistic. If you don't want to be scared, act as if you are brave. But of course, I can't directly transfer the experience. So for instance, I am pretty agnostic, atheist. I'm not a believer. Part of the Bible book where I followed all the rules of the Bible was to try to find, is there anything in religion that I don't have in my life that would be useful, that would make my life better?
Mm-hmm.
And I did find some things, the community, the rituals I like, but I'm still pretty agnostic, atheist. But I will say, while I was doing that project, I was praying like 5-10 times a day. And because I was acting that way, it really did start to affect my mind. And I would have these moments where I was a believer, and that I wrote about it, but that's a very hard experience too.
Sure.
To, you would have to go through it yourself to actually experience it. So
wow, that's like full Nietzsche there though, right? Like, God created man, and in exchange, man returned the favor, right? He created God, right? That's so interesting.
Right.
But yes, also probably very difficult to fully capture, just with words. So that's interesting. Can we camp on the, obviously if you're talking Bible, you're talking living the Bible and all the rules, that's Old Testament, right? This is like
right.
Orthodox, essentially. You were an Orthodox Jew for a year. Is that
sort of?
Yeah, and I'm ignorant. Clean up my ignorance, please.
What happened was I grew up with very little religion. And as I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So okay. Not very. But I was very interested in, am I missing anything by not having religion? I also had a secondary motive, which was trying to show that fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, is a bad idea, that we should not take the Bible completely literally and not believe that the earth was created 5,000 years
ago. And by extension, I would assume you mean we should not take any religious text in pure literary, fundamentalist terms.
Okay. Fundamentalism, whether it's religious or non-religious, whether it's communist or free market, I think fundamentalism is dangerous. But there was a more earnest idea of what can I take from these traditions to make my life better? And as I said, there were many takeaways, including gratitude. That sort of spawned the gratitude book. But to delve into it, I thought, well, why don't I just follow in the footsteps of my ancestors and try to follow every rule in the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures. So I wanted to follow the famous ones, like the Ten Commandments, and love your neighbor. But there are hundreds of rules that they don't teach you in Sunday school, that you cannot shave the corners of your beard, according to Leviticus. I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow, and I looked like Gandalf. You can't wear clothes made of different fibers, two different types of fabric. That's an abomination, according to the Bible.
So no blends.
Cotton blends.
Yeah.
So it was an extraordinary experience. And as I say, there were some wonderful parts to it and some terrible parts to it. But as always, I feel that it changed my life for the better. I got the gratitude. I don't gossip. I still gossip because I'm a human, but I don't gossip as much. There are types of gossip, I think, that are okay and types that aren't. So I try to be a more responsible gossiper. So many things, dozens of things, and I can go into them if you want, but that was the genesis, so to speak.
So I'm curious, in all of these, formats, right? Whether it was, essentially call that as constraints of the spirit, right? Like it's putting all of these constraints in your life for the purpose of, spiritual forging, right? And then the body one was putting all these constraints in your life to forge the body. And you had one for the mind, reading the encyclopedia. So, one of my general sort of utilitarian principles in life is that the more you can reduce the need to make decisions, the more you can accomplish.
Yeah.
And so in these years, it sounds like you significantly, especially following all those rules in the Bible, you significantly reduce the amount of decisions that you need to make, because a certain number of these decisions had already been made and they were put in place. And for at least a year, they were the bumpers of your life, right?
Totally.
And so I'm curious, did you find yourself to be a lot more productive in the app, with all these constraints in place?
I love that. Yeah. Well, there are two things I want to say. They're related. One is, I totally agree. I love the idea that constraints are necessary for creativity. Constraints and limits help with creativity. If you say to someone, write a story, they'll just look at the computer, and just, at least I will, I'll be like, what do I do? But if you say, write a story about what life would be like if you were a raccoon or whatever it is, give them a very specific thing, and then it's much easier. I also agree with what you said about the paradoxical truth that sometimes freedom from choice is as important as freedom of choice. I think they're both great. I thank God I live in the United States, where we do have more choices than in many other cultures. But there are studies, as you know, that show when we have too many choices, when you're hit with 400 cereals, we're not happy, because it's too stressful to make those choices. We're happier with three or four cereals.
Right.
So I loved having that architecture. So the Bible provided one sort of architecture. And as you say, the health one did. And that is another big takeaway from these projects, is that I do provide structure for myself. And within that structure, I can be creative. But I'm a big believer in even in checklists. So I have like a list, a little list of 20 things I try to do every morning. And I find it makes my life better. It makes it more productive. I could try to remember those, but having them written down just makes it so much easier. And some of them are, you know, so obvious, you would think I don't need to, like, brush my teeth. Some of them are, you know, one is I have to, I don't have to, but I make myself spend 15 minutes every day, every morning, brainstorming ideas, because ideas, I believe, are, they're the lifeblood of being a writer, but also being an entrepreneur. And writing is sort of like being an entrepreneur. So I'm a huge fan in setting aside that 15 minute block, very structured block. Here's 15 minutes. You can't do anything but come up with ideas. And I even have structured ways to come up with ideas. It's not like I'm just sitting there with no structure. I'm like, you know, I'll look at the list of 10 biggest news stories that day, and I will brainstorm about that. And I'll have strategies on brainstorm. Like, one strategy is like, what if it were the opposite of that? Or what if I take the small thing and make it big? So that's a long way of saying I am a big fan of constraints.
So were you, did you become more structured through these experiments and realizing that the, you know, call it the meta benefit of all these experiments was, at the end of the day, just structure is kind of its own reward, you know, whatever you choose to make that structure? Or were you always pretty, call it, I don't know, fastidious in that way?
No, I think it was a learning process.
Yeah.
I think, because I think when you're young, you're like, oh, it's great to have no structure and do whatever you want. And then you don't get anything done and you're not happy. So what I like is imposing my own structure, my own constraints on myself. I don't like having other people tell me what to do.
Yeah, I think we should clarify for the audience that I don't think either one of us are fascists, where we're suggesting that we or anybody else should get to tell you what your constraints need to be. But we're supportive of the idea that, you know, ratcheting down as many of the variables in your life as possible creates the maximum freedom and opportunity in the ones that you don't.
Right. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that I'm not a fascist.
A couple of Jewish fascists would not be a productive conversation.
But I do. Yes, I am a big fan of self-imposed constraints. I think that is the key. And I mean, I think I'm too far. I think I have more of an entrepreneurial personality in that, and you can tell me more, that I really do have trouble being told what to do. Like, you know, I can't do exercise classes because I don't like people telling me how to exercise. I think there's pros and cons to that. I think I'm too far on the side of hating people telling me what to do, because sometimes in life, I mean, certainly in my 20s and 30s, when I worked for other people, I had to do what they told me. So
thank you for serving up the next thing that I want to talk about, because just a little bit of context. Well, and actually, it's interesting. I'm trying to think when it was recently that I was talking to somebody about how there's a high level of correlation between entrepreneurship and some degree of literally what the DSM calls oppositional defiant disorder, of like, you know, forgive me, but to quote Zach LaRocca from Rage Against the Machine, what's that song that's like, no, I won't do what you tell me. No, I won't. You know, that's, sorry, it's like pretty intense, but like I literally will like play that song, and as much as I'm like, you know, I look a little nuts, I totally resonate with it. I love it. And like, I even think of my other favorite songs. Like, there's a song like Kitchen Sink by 21 Pilots. And he's just screaming, leave me alone. And I like get goosebumps all over my whole body. And I just like, sorry, I hope I didn't offend you there by like cursing.
Not at all. I mean, it's fascinating.
But anyway, but we're you're right. I think that makes us very entrepreneurial. And so, but here's the nice thing. Assuming that like attracts like, I think it's a fair statement that a lot of my audience, they kind of don't like authority either.
Right.
Or they might've found different podcasts to be into. and a different host to resonate with. So assuming that there's a large group of us, you know, malcontent rebels with or without causes here, let's talk about that. So in your 20s and your 30s, before I guess your art set you free financially, you had column jobs. You had traditional jobs with bosses. Is that that's true?
And I was very good at following orders. I was good. I didn't like it, but I thought, and in the end, maybe it was good because it helped me get to a place where I could do my own thing. And I would go above and beyond. Like my, I was taught, you know, as a kid, like, you know, when they say jump, how you say how high, it's like, I really took it. I when they gave me a project, I would do more than they asked.
What were the jobs?
Well, they're all journalism. I started out working for a tiny newspaper, and then I worked for Esquire magazine. I worked for Entertainment Weekly magazine.
But you were still getting to write.
Yeah, I was still writing.
So to some degree, your job
they would
was...
rewrite, but they would rewrite you. Yeah, that was... wait, I just want to go back because I want to dig in just a bit on the authority, like the... resisting authority versus accepting authority. Because I think one of my big themes is that everything is complicated. Nothing is black and white. And there are nuances. And the one problem with the world is everyone sees, not everyone, but so that would be a black and white thing to say. Many people see the world as black and white, and it's not. So there are areas where I think it's super important to not be anti-authority, like, you know, that would be
fundamentalist to just say like all authority is bad.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like I got the vaccine and I would do it again. You know, I'm going to keep getting the vaccine because I do believe as flawed as science can be and as flawed as the CDC can be, the overall point of getting a vaccine is definitely a good idea. So that, it's always a balance for me, like resisting authority and doing my own thing versus there are times when it's important for the world and for society to, you know, believe in experts.
So what was your mindset then being, you know, somewhere on the ODD spectrum, the oppositional defiant spectrum, right. Which, you know, I mean, if you're a 10, you're probably in prison. So like, I don't think either of us are, I mean, we're probably maybe like a 3 and a 2 or something, you know, but still we're on it, which means certain things are harder for us than maybe other people. We're less compliant. What was it like going through your 20s? Like, did you always have this sense of like, man, I'm biding my time. I'm prepping my spot. I'm getting ready to make my move. But like, I know when the time comes, I got to make a break because I can't handle, I don't want to live like this forever. Like,
yes.
Was it formulating like that?
There was some of that. And I also think, you know, I did a huge amount of side hustling. And I think that is where my entrepreneurial spirit could flourish. So I would do my job.
And you were giving yourself an outlet. Like, do you feel like if you hadn't had that outlet, you might have like just exploded?
It would have been terrible.
Okay.
So I would work really hard on my day job for the 8 hours that I needed to get it all done. But then I would try to write books or pitch articles to other outlets that were things I wanted to do that no one was telling me to do. And that was huge. And so that was sort of, you know, 30% of my work life in my 20s and 30s. Now it's like 80% of my work life. And I feel very, very lucky.
So that's so cool. I talk to people a lot about this and I love when I meet people. Well, you know, what can I say? I'm selfish. I like when I meet people that validate the things that I say, don't we all? But I tell people, I say like, look, you're stuck. Even to your point about not being black and white, people will use language like I'm stuck in my day job. I got the 9 to 5. I got the ball and chain. I got like, they act so fatalistic. And it's like, no, you know, this is a constraint for you, but I, you know, there are no jobs that employ us 168 hours a week or even whatever that minus 56 hours of sleep would be, you know, 112, like there's no job that employs us with all our time. So the idea is, how do you do something in your part, in your spare time? And a lot of people I've learned, you know, I run an entrepreneurial education platform. So I have a lot of direct visibility on not only the mechanics of people starting up or their side hustle or spinning up their business or whatever, but also a lot of the psychological BS that people use to get in their own way. Right.
Right.
And a lot of it is very black and white. It's like, if I can't go all in on my business, I don't want to be in at all on my business, because it's like, I'm just angry and I'd rather just, you know, cut off my nose to spite my face. And I'm like, no, no. So you got your 40 hours over here. You got your, you know, 20 auxiliary hours to support your 40 hours, which is like commuting and brushing your teeth and putting on your clothes or whatever. But like, you can carve out some time. And the goal is to like titrate off the, I must do what they say vocation, and titrate into the, I get to do what I want vocation. And like you said, you went from 80-20 to 20-80. Like, nobody's ever completely free of being told what to do.
Right. Right. I got my editor, my publisher.
And how long did it take for that seesaw?
Long time, like 20 years, you know, 20, 25 years. And just to add a little more of the nuance, the grays to it, even when you're stuck in that super annoying, constraining job, there are opportunities for creativity. Not always, you know, sometimes there's things that you just have to do the way they say. But certainly when I would get an assignment that I hated, I would try to write it in a way that made me happy, that was more creative. Like, I was at Entertainment Weekly, which was an entertainment magazine. And I was there during the height of the boy bands, the first wave of boy bands. So I had to write.
So like, Backstreet Boys or NSYNC? Like,
yeah.
I'm asking you, pick your poison.
Oh, well, I couldn't care less. That was part of the problem.
Right.
Like, so they assigned me an article, like, you know, write a big profile of Backstreet Boys and why they're so wonderful. And it just made my stomach sink. So, but I was like, what if I wrote it in the voice of a 14-year-old girl, trying to get inside the mind of a 14-year girl? And then at least that's more creative and fun. And, you know, it could have been terrible. It was a big swing, but it actually, people really responded to it. So even when you're given a really crappy assignment, maybe there are ways to do it in more creative ways.
So maybe we can extract some wisdom from that little anecdote there, which, by the way, is, I mean, the reason I have this podcast is because I am on this, I'm on one man's humble quest to find the common denominator of outlier success, basically. Like, it's like, that's what I'm probing for in every conversation. And I think that's why people are on this journey with me, is like, you know, we're like a parabola. We'll never actually touch the asymptote. Like, I don't think we'll ever get there, but we get closer and closer and closer. And in so doing, we have a great experience and we learn a lot. So to potentially extract some timeless wisdom from that little anecdote, the act of asking what must be true for me to not hate this assignment, basically, I'll get in the mind of someone else and I'll turn it into this thought experiment. And that not only, I mean, like you said, it was a risk. You took a risk. So A, risk taking, part of said formula. And you said it was a big hit, right?
I mean, people
loved it. Do you feel like that advanced your career?
Sure. Every little thing helps. It's certainly.
Did it get you one step closer to the day when you didn't have to deal with so much BS?
I believe so, because it was something that people noticed. If I had just written a straight ahead article, and that was with every assignment, because that one of the things that I most hated was writing profiles of celebrities, but that was a big part of my job. So always I would try to come up with how can I do this without hating it? And I did one early on with Jon Stewart that I loved, because the idea was I wrote a straight ahead, boring profile. Like a regular celebrity profile you'd see in any magazine. And I asked him to annotate it. So he wrote in the margin, like, oh, you're full of shit. This is not right. You know, oh, this makes me sound less so Jewy. What's going on here? So he made jokes in the margins. And and it made it so much more interesting. So,
oh, you just published it with the annotations.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We published everything. Yeah. Cause I also, and that goes back to risk taking. Cause I kind of looked like an ass in a lot of it. Cause you know, I was the straight man. I would, you know, I would make a comment about that, you know, he was 5'6" or whatever he is. And he's like, you know, he would mock me for being an ass, but it was such a more interesting read than just a regular profile.
So I love that. So then again, extracting a formula, cause you know, let's be honest, there's somebody listening to this who does have a job that involves assignments they don't like. So taking the risk that gets you noticed, and it's a calculated risk based on what's going to make this assignment more enjoyable. That
right.
Because I actually deeply believe this in the world we live in today. I think that it is virtually, I'm curious your comment on this statement. Like, am I being too fundamentalist? It is virtually impossible to succeed in the world today without being noticed. Hey there, sorry to interrupt the show, but I just have a quick favor to ask. So we recently broke into the top 100 podcasts in the entrepreneurship category. We've been hovering around 75 and we're really trying to push up into like the top 20 and grow the impact of the show. So if you enjoy what we do here and you're a supporter, the biggest thing you could do to help would be to leave us a positive review. Whatever platform you're listening on, you should be able to leave a quick review. Let the world know what you like about the show. Thank you so much for your time and let's get back to it.
Oh yeah, I think that's you gotta cut through the clutter, as they used to say.
Yeah. Which wasn't always true. Like you could have been like, you know, I'm a humble whatever in whatever little town and I scale my efforts across 27 locations and now I'm a millionaire. Nobody knows who I am or whatever. I honestly think in the world today, there's like no way to be really successful without making some sort of a fuss.
Which is good and bad. Yeah, I don't know how I feel if there's some serious drawbacks to like, you know, the making a fuss and
or being creative or being novel or being distinct
right.
or being, I you mean, there's be, better
make
words.
A positive
than,
fuss. You can make
yeah,
a positive
yeah. Fuss is a pejorative way to say it.
But yeah, well, it brings to mind another little point that I wanted to make, because when I started as a writer, I hated the idea of putting myself out there for publicity and marketing because I thought, I'm a writer. You know, the whole point is I don't have to do this. I'm a writer.
Right.
And as you say, that's terrible because no one's going to notice and your book is going to disappear. So I had to embrace publicity and marketing. And the way I did it was I tried to reframe it to use a CVT concept. I reframed it as a creative endeavor. So it's similar to what we were talking about before. Take a crappy assignment and make it creative. And now I love it because instead of just, you know, I want to do things that publicize the book, but in an interesting way. So for instance, with the thank you book, I did a little video that said, I'm going to thank 1,000 people who read my book. I'm going to write a handwritten thank you note. Mm-hmm. And it was a major pain in the ass, pain in the hand, but it was wonderful. And I got a lot of attention because people would tweet pictures of the postcards I sent them.
Yeah, cool.
And similar to, you know, the Bible book, I wrote about sex advice from the Bible for Glamour magazine. Like that was, I felt, a creative way to get the word out instead of just the usual Q&A.
And is there any sex advice in the Old Testament other than like for procreation only?
Oh yeah. Well that, I mean,
you don't have to tell me what it is, but I'm just, it does exist, right?
Oh yeah. Well, okay. If you look at something called the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs, it is steamy.
Wow.
Like,
okay.
Oh yeah. It's like a love poetry. And some of the lines are like, your breasts are like two gazelles grazing in the field, literally. Okay. And
I'm trying to picture that.
Yeah. For us, it maybe not as resonant. Right.
But yeah, that was probably pretty provocative back in the day.
Yeah. Well, that was the lesson I took from that is like, be creative with your compliments. If you are going to give compliments, at least try to put some thought into them instead of like you hot. You know, like you may not want to use the gazelle, but use something creative and poetic.
So I do like this though. This idea of taking risks and getting noticed and like you said, and frankly to the audience, as you know, a lot of nascent entrepreneurial energy out there listening, like, I want to do this. I have a vision for my life that sort of requires that I do this and whatever this is. I mean, it could be opening your own taco stand or barbershop or launching an e-com store online, like, or writing your great novel. Like, it doesn't matter, but like there's people, you know, everybody's got a thing they've thought about and they just don't because it's not practical or it's not in, you know, the template or whatever. And so I love that a part of every unrealized dream is getting clear on who I would need to become to be the protagonist of that dream rather than this life.
Yeah.
And for you, it was like, okay, who do I need to become in order to be the protagonist of my dream as a successful, recognized, you know, author?
Right.
Is different than who I am in my life of maybe not wanting any attention. And so you had to find a way to cross that bridge that you could live with.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, for everyone to think about how do I cross the bridge from who I am to who I need to be to have the life that I want or the dream come true in a way that is still true to me.
Yeah.
And you did it artfully, it sounds like.
Right. I mean, I do think we are much more flexible than a lot of people give us credit for. So,
or then we give maybe give ourselves credit.
Oh yeah, certainly yeah. Give ourselves. For instance, I think that my default is introvert. I'm an introvert. But for my job, I have to be out there, not just talking to people to publicize my book, but to interview people. I have to approach, you know,
we had to find 1,000 people to say thank you just for one cup of coffee.
So, and it can be totally awkward. It can be like some of the most awkward conversations you've ever had. So as an introvert, it was especially painful. Like I would call like the woman who does pest control at the warehouse where the coffee beans are stored. And I'd be like, I know this is strange. I leaned into it. I know this is strange, but I just want to thank you for keeping the bugs out of my coffee. And I like waited and she's like, well, that is strange. But then she said, you know what? I love it. I don't get any positive feedback. So this was a nice change, like a positive crank phone call. But the point was I forced myself to do that. And I believe that introvert and extrovert are not black and white. You can sort of move between the two. I still like times where I like to be alone and brainstorm by myself or research, but I can also force myself to be an extrovert. And after a while, I'm always grateful that I did because I'm like, well, that was an interesting conversation or I'm glad I got to meet that person. So yeah, we should be a little more optimistic about how malleable our personalities are.
Yeah. I think that's a really, really important truth in the world today. Almost like an evolutionary, a momentary evolutionary reality. And what I mean by that is because I think we can all agree that like the pace of evolutionary change, and I don't just mean genetic evolution, I just mean like the rate of change in general is kind of accelerating, right? Like
absolutely.
Human civilization used to change in like millennium and then it would change in like centuries. And then now it changes like every 5 years we're like seem to reinvent ourselves, right? And so adaptation, whether it's personality adaptation, physical adaptation, and so forth, like moves a lot slower than society does now, right?
For sure.
And so that ability to almost chameleon-like, like selectively, or think of ourselves as a range of personalities or a range of potentials or a range of skills or talents, as opposed to like, you know, what's that? Growth mindset versus fixed mindset, I guess, is the Stanford terminology. I think it is almost that itself is survival of the fittest at this point. If you cannot be an extrovert when you need to be. In other words, if you're too locked into your self-definition as an introvert, you're toast in this world. If you are too locked into your definition as a private person who can't handle being looked at times, you're toast in this world. Like there's almost no allowable rigid self-definition anymore, because the world is like too varied and it's moving too fast.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, that is another, we've been talking about the meta themes of my work, and one of them is flexibility of all kinds, like trying to be flexible in your personality, trying to be cognitively flexible and see new solutions. That was the most recent book, The Puzzler, is all about that, the importance of cognitive flexibility. And you can't solve a good puzzle if you are stuck in one way of thinking. You have to, as they say, think outside the box. And I feel okay saying that, because that phrase is from a puzzle. Do you know the puzzle that it's from?
Yeah, it's the 9 dots, and they tell you to connect every dot with, is it 4 lines?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can't do it unless you go outside the limits of the box. Now, what I love is that I got an email yesterday from a reader who's like, you're not thinking far enough outside the box, because there are other solutions. Like you can roll the paper up. Right. So
fold it until all the points become a singularity or something.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Or he said, you know, these are not points, they're dots. So they have some volume, some space. So you can put it at the top of the dot, one line, and then the next line at the bottom of the dot. And you can do it in 3 lines. So I love that. That just made my day when I got that email.
I love that. I'm curious then, actually, we've only got, you know, I think 12 minutes of budgeted time left. So that's a 12-minute warning for the audience, but which is now a thing, by the way. There's now a thing called the 12-minute warning. So I'm curious, can we talk about the physical book, the year of trying to be essentially the healthiest man alive? Yeah,
sure, sure.
I haven't read that book. So do you mind? Can you, I guess as a starting point, can you kind of summarize the general modality that you, I mean, fitness, there's so many different philosophies around fitness. Like what did you try different ones over the course of a year? Did you like pick one macro model and stick with it? Like what was the approach?
The first one I tried hundreds. I was in terrible shape. And I just decided I'm going to try to get as healthy as possible. And okay. my wife was sort of, she said, I don't want to be a widow in my 40s, like get in shape. So I consulted the top doctors, top nutritionists, top researchers, and trainers. And I made a list of hundreds of health tips. And I tried to follow every one. And as you know, some of them are contradictory. So right, I would try one for a month. I would try another. Yeah. So, and I tried, like, I went through a bunch of different diets, a bunch of different exercise routines. And yeah, it was physically painful. Right. It was not quite as painful as your guest who ran 50 triathlons in 50 weeks or 50 days.
Right.
But it was certainly, I was out there testing everything from the caveman workout where you'd crawl around in the forest to, trying new ways to go to the bathroom. Like, you know, I had a little device that you would put over your toilet so you could crouch and make it like, you know, you were out in the fields of the savanna. And of course, like everything, I don't do everything I did because it was literally a 24-hour job. So I can't,
right.
But there were many things I took away that have made my life better. And I'm happy to tell you a couple.
I actually would love to know. I mean, in terms of like efficacy, like most bang for the buck, what especially for, again, you know, an audience of aspiring or entrepreneurs that are aspiring to be as high performance as possible, myself included, like what are some things that you have found really level you up?
Well, one big theme was, We all kind, despite the debates around the edges, we all kind of know what makes us healthy, which is exercise and eating real food instead of crappy processed food.
Right.
Getting sleep is hugely important. Not stressing. that sleep and stress are very, you know, we, it's not all about diet and exercise. It's also sleep and stress. So we all know that these are important things, but the challenge is, how do we do it? How do we, and that is where I think it's very important to come up with strategies on, to make yourself act in a healthy way, like we were talking, to reduce your choices. So for instance, just mentally, I try to think, you know what, the pantry, I'm going to stay away from the pantry all day and just go to the fridge. That's an easy rule to remember because the fridge has real food, food
that
rots.
Needs to be refrigerated or it goes bad.
Yeah.
Right.
And the pantry is like, you know, crap that will last 1,000 years because it's got, in terms of getting exercise, like, don't do, you're going to only do exercise you enjoy in the long run. Like, so find something you enjoy. Otherwise you'll just like, you know, just drop it after a while. And I find, I try to come up with interesting, fun ways to exercise. The one I'm doing now, I'm writing a piece for Men's Health about it, is I am walking to the moon, by which I mean I have a treadmill desk, which I love to write emails on my treadmill desk, and it's angled up slightly at like 12%.
Right.
So every day I'm walking, it keeps track of my vertical. So
you're trying to cover the vertical climb equivalent of getting to the moon?
I'm sorry, did I say moon? I said meant space. I'm walking to space. Because yes, I walk about 1,000 feet per day up, like the Eiffel Tower, the equivalent of the Eiffel Tower. And space starts at 330,000 feet. So it'll take me about a year. I'm like about 200,000 feet. So that kind of fun, interesting, experimental mindset really helps me with the exercise, making it a fun, making it a game, gamify it.
Yeah. So what are, I'm a big fan of gamifying life. In fact, I'm with the release of my book, I'm doing a masterclass, an Unlock Your Potential masterclass inside my entrepreneurial education platform. And sort of the big catharsis of the class is turning your life into a predictable and winnable game.
Nice.
And then not only do you get a higher probability result, you also have a lot more fun when you do that.
Right.
So, from one gamer to another, then, share some tip, like what are some other aspects of life that you have you figured out how to gamify?
Well, I'll tell you one that's been huge is, and I got this from The Puzzler, because, puzzles are sort of cousins to games.
Sure.
And Quincy Jones, the musician, he has a phrase I love. He says, "I don't have problems, I have puzzles." So if you view the world, if you view your challenges as a series of puzzles instead of problems, because problems, the connotation is that they're struggled, they're negative, they're hard to, they might not have a solution. But puzzles, it's like, oh, well, I have, you know, it might require playfulness and I can solve this. And it is I find that is a much better frame to go through the world. And I'll give you a very specific example of when I, you know, politics, of course, now is ridiculously divisive. So if I'm talking to someone from the other side of the political spectrum, I used to see it as like a war, like, right. I'm going to beat them down with my facts and I'm going to win this war of words. That rarely works, if ever. And it often has the opposite effect.
Right.
It just pisses people off. So instead, I go into conversations with people who I disagree with on politics or anything else. And I see it as a puzzle. Like, let's turn this into a puzzle. What do we really disagree on? What is the crux of our disagreement? Mm-hmm. What evidence could we present to each other that might make us change our mind? What are the ways forward? And so make it almost a collaborative game. You're not out to get each other. You're trying to solve this mystery together of why do we disagree? And it is much more productive. And as you say, much more fun.
You know, I love that approach. And you know, I also love that we have CBT in common because there's sort of a common framework there that, like, I think people a lot of times get mired in the content of whatever they believe or whatever they're talking about. And it's like, at the end of the day, what you're saying is getting down to the first principles and finding out which ones align and ultimately trying to pinpoint, like, what is your postulate that differs, that contradicts my postulate. And actually, exactly. That's the only thing we really need to talk about. Everything right. else is just content.
Totally. Absolutely.
I love that. And then it becomes like dialectical and like interesting rather than just like you said, like oppositional.
Yeah. I mean, I used to get so angry and now it's much more interesting. It's like, okay, this is why we disagree. And I think that's the only way out. You're never going to, well, we don't talk in black and white. So you're rarely going to convince someone by saying, you know, this is true and you're wrong and the world is round. What are you, an idiot? You know, say, why do you believe the earth is flat? And, you know, what could I show you that might convince you the earth is round? Those kinds of questions are so important.
So I really like, your Quincy Jones illusion that he doesn't have problems. He has puzzles. You know, one of the things I even talk about this in my book, and now I'm wishing, man, maybe I should go tweak that chapter. I talk a lot about reframing problems as challenges, but it occurs to me distinction that, you know, both challenges and puzzles make you better, but a challenge doesn't get fundamental. Like, a challenge is something you complete. A puzzle is something you solve. And a challenge doesn't get fundamentally easier the second time. It's still, because all you did was complete it, right? But a puzzle, and so I'm actually thinking I like better the idea of reframing problems as puzzles, because once you solve it, if it recurs in your life, you get to have less stress around it because, you know what I mean? It's going to be easier to complete the second time. Whereas a marathon doesn't technically, like, nothing fundamentally changes about the challenge itself, right?
Yeah.
So I really like that. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thank Quincy Jones too.
I thank Quincy for a lot of things. I thank him for Thriller and Bad and many other great things. And Rashida.
Oh, wonderful.
Daughter from The Office. Great, great actress. Okay. Listen, we're like out of time. This flew by.
That was great. Loved it.
A couple of fascist Jews yucking it up, and here
that's going to be taken out of context.
I know, right?
I will not sign off on that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I will say that I had a great time, and
no, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
editors, leave that in. No, seriously, thank you. How can the world go? Obviously, you've got your books, but how else can the world go get to know more about you?
The usual places, my website is ajjacobs.com, and I'm on Twitter at ajjacobs and all those other social media sites. And I love to hear from people. So yeah, reach out.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on Unlock Your Potential. This has been truly a lot of fun.
I had a great time. Thank you.
I wouldn't degenerate us into totally politically incorrect humor if I wasn't actually having a blast talking to you. So.
Good. That's a compliment.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening. And especially if you like or share or leave a review, thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.